Well, good evening and welcome to St. Patrick's. If I can encourage you to grab your coffee or your tea and to come forward quickly, not least because the cakes are going fast, do come and sit down. My name is David King here, and you are very welcome indeed. It's good to see you, especially maybe if this is your first time here at St. Patrick's. You're especially welcome. We pray and hope that this will be an evening where your eyes are opened and that you have a chance to ask your questions and think more about God's Word, the Bible. Our guest speaker today is a man called Chris Sinkinson. I came across Chris last summer at the Keswick Convention where he did the Bible readings in the morning, and I loved them. I loved them partly, I've got to say, because as many of you know, I used to be a history teacher, and this man brings history to life, but also because it just helped me understand the Bible better. And each day, even though they were the earliest sessions, and this was meant to be a bit of a break, I was eager to get there and hear them. And so I was thinking about what we might do this year, I thought I would just send, somebody said, why don't you send an email off to him with no expectation? And he emailed back saying he would love to come, which I was greatly encouraged by and somewhat surprised until I discovered you have a Wallington connection. And maybe that was in our favour. So I'm going to hand over to Chris now, and I hope you have a lovely evening.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you for that welcome. No, the reason why I'm here, you are a very persuasive man. And it's a privilege to come and share with you tonight. I share with you a love of history, a passion for history, which I think will come through this evening. But obviously combining that with a passion for the Bible and wanting to just share with you tonight on why I'm confident that the Bible is real history. And I want to share with you some of the things that have been found in archaeology and in various areas of historical research that confirm the reliability of the Bible. I'll speak for quite a while. I'm not making promises, but probably around seven or so, we'll have an opportunity for just open mic questions. And then I'll finish off what I've got to say after that little bit of time of interaction. So hang in there as I share with you now a material I want to cover. Oh, yeah, the Wallington connection is fairly loose, but my wife, I mean, she's fairly loose, but my wife was at Wallington School for Girls, Wallington High School for Girls. So that was quite a few years ago when my wife finished from there. So I used to come up to, well, she was in Carshalton at that time, so I used to come up to Carshalton when I was courting. And so I knew this part of the world quite well at that time. Now I'm pastor of a church down on the edge of the New Forest, and I teach at Morelands College. I teach theology there, so that's near to Bournemouth. That's where I am now. So I want to talk to you tonight for a while about archaeology and its relevance to the Bible. Now, originally, I wanted to study archaeology. That was what I thought I would be doing. And in fact, I went to begin studying archaeology at Southampton University. I was a student there, and my interest in archaeology had been kindled by one particular movie, I think, that was big in the 1980s. And you can probably guess what that movie is. But I discovered that actually the study of archaeology has very little to do with Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. It had more to do with standing in wet English fields on Saturdays while other students were doing other things, wondering why I was spending my time this way. And archaeology, I discovered, is far more of a painstaking discipline than the world of Indiana Jones suggested. There was no running down tunnels and avoiding rolling balls or whatever else Indiana Jones got up to. A very painstaking science. Actually, I switched subjects during my time at Southampton, and by a roundabout way, having gone into theology and Christian ministry, I've kind of come back to archaeology and now been involved in some excavations at a site in Israel, Bethsaida, north shore of the Sea of Galilee. And with the theology that I teach at college, I'm involved in trying to explain this material to students and help them to see how history and archaeology sheds light on how we read the Bible and helps to confirm that the Bible is accurate history. And so that's in a roundabout way how I've got back to archaeology again. The land of Israel is an incredible place to see how the land itself opens up all sorts of interesting insights into the biblical record. There is so much being done. Trying to keep up with it is very difficult. Every year new things are discovered. You know, the real reason why they call it the Holy Land, it's not the Holy Land, it's the land full of holes. It's the Holy Land, because there are so many holes being dug all the time. So much is emerging from the ground. And I'll share with you some of that this evening. I'll be using the screen as well. Hopefully that the pictures are clear enough just to show you what we're talking about. And the first thing to say is that there is something about the land of Israel that lends itself to archaeology. And it's a theme that will come up again in a number of ways in what we look at tonight. And it's to do with this. What you're looking at there, the telltale signs, is not actually a hill. It may look like a hill, but actually when you think about the outline of that hill, that picture, it's quite an artificial looking hill. The edges don't quite look right. It doesn't look natural. And that's because it isn't natural. It's what archaeologists have called a tell. T-E-L. It's just the Arabic word for a hill. But it's not a hill, and that's why they keep the name Tell. Tells appear from Syria all the way down to Egypt on the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean. And there are lots of them in the land of Israel. And tells are incredibly important for archaeology, and it's just fascinating that it happens to be in the land of the Bible, because the tell provides a record, a protected record of ancient history. What you're actually looking at there are the remains of thousands of years of occupation. Well, what happened in that part of the world is that people would originally settle thousands of years ago or on a low-lying hill where there would be a spring nearby to supply water. And then for some reason, their city would be destroyed, maybe an earthquake or maybe an invading army. And on the ruins and the debris, they'd fill in all the gaps, flatten it off as a platform, and then build on top. And then another invasion would take place. You know, it's a land of turmoil around the Middle East. We still see that on the news today. Sadly, I mean, those tragic stories we see on our news right now, sadly, that's been the story of thousands of years in that part of the world. And after invasions and occupations, cities would be destroyed, demolished, then resettled and reoccupied, and over thousands of years they'd rise high in the air. And what that means is that when they were finally abandoned and the grass grows over, like you see in this particular tell, it would preserve a record of where people had lived for thousands of years. So if I just show you on this next slide, well, this next photograph, you just see there an aerial view of one hill. It's looking down from an aeroplane, okay, on a hill, and you can see the lighter bits of ground. That's where they've excavated, and that would be an aerial view of a tell, Megiddo, where they have found occupation going back for thousands of years, where people have lived on a particular site in the land of Israel. So a wonderful thing about a tell is it preserves the record, the remains of ancient history. Here's a picture of Jericho on the left-hand side. What a mess. If you have been out to Israel or are planning a trip to Israel, be warned, Jericho is the ugliest tell in the ancient world. And the reason why it's so ugly is because of the archaeologists. Look what they did to it. What was a beautiful hill has been extensively excavated, and that's why it looks such a mess, with trenches being dug and holes being dug. And that's because Jericho, the city of Jericho, is the oldest continuously occupied city in the entire world. It's one of the very first cities, not the first, but one of the very first cities, and it was the oldest continuously occupied city. And so obviously trenches have been dug and all sorts of things have been discovered, because there is a record preserved of the ancient world and the history, biblical history of the Old Testament, preserved in the record at Jericho. Just a little bit about how archaeologists do their thing. I won't spend too long on this, but in olden days, like back in 1950s, in the olden days, they dug trenches. Because if you think about it, a tell, if it's a hill like that and you want to instantly get an idea of the historical record, who lived there when, you would just dig a trench right through it. It's like taking a slice of layer cake. We've got some cake on the tables, haven't we? Sponge cakes and so on. If you look at a slice of cake, you can see the layers with maybe some jam in the middle, maybe some butter or cream. I'm getting hungry looking at that. And your sponge. And you look at the layers. Well, taking a slice like a trench will give you an exposure of the layers of occupation of thousands of years. Back in the 1950s, that's how they did it. Nowadays, it's not done that way. It's done even more slowly than it was then. And it's done by this grid method of opening up a grid and only gradually, very carefully surveying a grid and only gradually going down. Because the trouble of a trench is you ruin as much as you discover. You destroy things in the process of trying to discover them. And so this grid method is used nowadays. It's used at the various sites. You can see how the grid will open up what will be walls in this particular case, walls of houses and so on. Same thing's done underwater, by the way. I'm not going to talk about that now, but underwater archaeology does the same thing nowadays. Have a grid and, of course, with diving equipment, go down and survey very small squares, very small grids. Just say a couple of things about a site that I've been involved in, because this is where my interest has kind of been nurtured and encouraged even further. It's a tell, it's a site, which I've mentioned earlier, on the north shore of Galilee, which until the late 1980s, had not been excavated. It was just one of these, there's still a few, one of these hills that nobody had touched. And it was in Galilee, just off the edge of the Sea of Galilee. And what was discovered there is a lost city of the Bible. In fact, I can tell you right now, there are actually two lost cities of the Bible that are there. One which everybody agrees is there, and there's another ancient city that I'll tell you about in a moment. Okay, there's the aerial view again. So we're up in the aeroplane looking down. It's a hill. It's got trees on it. It's got rocks and so on. And nobody knew what it was. Nobody had excavated it until the late 1980s, and then it was identified. And it was identified, and it's now confirmed as the city of Bethsaida. It's one of the three cities that Jesus is particularly associated with in Galilee. So that would be Capernaum, Chorazin, and Bethsaida, three cities in the north of Galilee where Jesus' ministry is associated. Well, Capernaum was well known, well understood. Chorazin is pretty well clear where that's been identified. Nobody knew where Bethsaida was. Until the late 1980s, early 90s, nobody knew. It had been lost to history. It had been obviously resettled and then abandoned, and nobody knew where it was. Now, you might think, hang on a minute, though, if there's a big tell here in Galilee, why didn't people immediately just guess that would be Bethsaida? Well, there was a problem, and that is that it was a good 3/4 mile away from the sea. And if you read the Gospels, Bethsaida, the home of three apostles, very important town for Jesus, it's a fishing town. It's a town where the fishermen went from. So what on earth would a fishing town be doing nearly a mile away from the Sea of Galilee? And so it was thought this couldn't possibly be, whatever it was under that hill, it couldn't possibly be Bethsaida. Well, by painstaking archaeology, the true story of this site has emerged over time. And that includes a major city entrance. You can just about make out the... can you see there's a little statue on the right-hand side, smaller one to the left, a bigger one up some steps, and it shows a bull-headed figure. I'm going to tell you a bit more about that in a moment, but a bull-headed figure on the statue there that's been carved. A major entranceway into a city. Now, Bethsaida, time of Jesus, nearly 3/4 mile away from the sea, but what's been discovered is the Galilee at that time stretched further north. There was a system of lagoons which had since silted up. So over 2,000 years since the time of Jesus, silt had meant that you couldn't actually any longer get from Bethsaida into the Sea of Galilee. The lagoons had gone. That's one of the reasons why it was abandoned and forgotten about, because of that gap that had been created. But through scientific survey, using some actually equipment borrowed from BP, I think it is, the British Petroleum, who lent it, through scientific research, they discovered that originally the lagoons had stretched the Sea of Galilee to the edge of this particular town. But under Bethsaida, so that would be near the top, the time of Jesus, the top of this hill, as they dug down, and what's presently going on, is an even more elaborate city from Old Testament times has been emerging. Very significant city, very wealthy city. It would have been on the borders of Israel, And this now is being discovered is another lost city from the Old Testament, a city referred to in the Old Testament that nobody has ever been able to identify until now. And that's the city of Geshur. Now, you may not have heard of Geshur. Don't worry if you haven't heard of Geshur. It's not often spoken of in sermons and Bible studies. But it was an important town in the ancient world. The Geshurites weren't actually Israelites, but they lived on the border, and they were very friendly to the Israelites. In fact, King David married a daughter of the king of Geshur. So this is actually a very important town in Old Testament times, and has only just emerged now into the light of day. So I keep walking forward, don't I? I like getting close to you. So the tell, I'm explaining, is part of the secret as to why Israel offers so much opportunity for archaeology and so much that will help us to open up the reliability of the Bible. Now, with that as the background, that's just the background, let's think about some of the things that have been found and what light it casts on the Bible. Now, there are lots of questions we might have about the reliability of the Bible. Sadly, one of the things I find really frustrating is when the I was going to mention a particular television provider. I won't do that because there's more than one. But when a television provider seeks to present a documentary series on the Bible or on the reliability of the Bible, it seems to me that often they will privilege the most skeptical points of view. So you will tend to find very skeptical people being given the prominent position of explaining that there's not really any evidence for what the Bible shows or for the stories of the Bible. And that kind of message is the message that's conveyed far too often in a lot of our broadcasting, a lot of our media. And it simply isn't true. Archaeology is a fairly young discipline. It's only really about 100 years old, or even less than that, what we would call archaeology. So it's a relatively young discipline. And the fact is that over that 100 years, find after find after find has helped to confirm that the biblical record is reliable, and there is not one thing that's been found that undermines confidence in the Bible as a reliable record. Now, I'm going to try and show you that in a few minutes, and maybe there'll be questions that you've got, maybe things that you've come across or heard about, but I'll try and explain that. Let's start, though, with a difficult question, which throws up some other issues, and that's the question, well, okay, let's go right back then. Let's think about something like the Exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and this story of Moses and the plagues. Where is the evidence in archaeology or history that what the Bible says about Moses and the plagues and the crossing of the sea, that it actually happened? Where, for example, do the Egyptians in their records tell us anything about Moses? Maybe, and you sometimes hear this said, maybe it's all a myth. A legend. Maybe the Israelites are a mythical people. Maybe Moses was a fictitious hero, didn't really exist. Maybe it's all an invented story. After all, what do we know outside of the Bible that casts light on these events that we read about? Well, I would admit straight away that, of course, the further back we go in time, the less there is to go on. And that's inevitable. As the years go by, less is preserved from the ancient world. The Exodus that we read about regarding Moses, we're talking about an event 3,500 years ago, somewhere around 1,400 BC, long, long ago, and lots from that time is lost to history, but not everything. Let's have a look at some of the records from Egypt. Number one, we do know that people from the land of Canaan, Semitic people, as they would be called, from Canaan, did come and settle in Egypt around the time of the patriarchs. So this is the time from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This image on the screen, not so clear, but okay, you may just about be able to pick it out. This is from the Beni Hassan tomb scene. And it's a tomb scene that dates to the time of the patriarchs and shows some of the people from Canaan coming to settle in the land of Egypt. They're coming into Egypt to work, to find food and so on, perhaps escaping from difficult conditions in Canaan. They're bringing with them their animals, but we can also see in the Beni Hassan tomb scene inscriptions showing their national dress, what's actually a many-weave coat. You know, in the book of Genesis, we read about Joseph wearing a technicolor dream coat. Well, no, actually, it doesn't say that. That was Andrew Lloyd Webber's gloss on it. It's a many-weave coat, not actually a many-coloured coat, a many-weave coat. And this type of many-weave coat is exactly what we see in this picture of Semitic people coming from Canaan. It shows their instruments and their families and their animals all coming to settle in the land at a time when foreigners were welcome, when foreigners were welcome to be part of Egypt and to work in some capacity. The time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The time when Joseph could have ascended to be a prime minister. However, we then know that within a couple of hundred years or so, the climate changed. I don't mean the environmental climate, I mean the political climate had changed. And those same foreigners were no longer welcome. They were now being treated as slaves. This inscription, this image, I should say, shows slaves in Egypt being forced to bake bricks, to create the kind of baked bricks used in building projects. Don't let anybody ever tell you that Egypt never used slave labor, and therefore the Israelites couldn't have been slaves in Egypt. That kind of idea goes around, because it is true that we pretty well assure that the Egyptians did not use slaves to build the pyramids. The pyramids were built by Egyptian nationals. It was part of their taxation system. They didn't use slaves to build the pyramids. But the pyramids were long before the time of the Israelites, the time of Exodus. Pyramid building finished 1,000 years before the Exodus. That was long before, you know, getting back into kind of Stonehenge territory, okay, much, much earlier in time. By the time of Moses, they're building storehouses, we read, not pyramids. And those are built out of sun-dried or baked bricks, in this case, bricks baked over fire. And in this image you have non-Egyptians being used as slave labor to bake these bricks. And interestingly, in the Egyptian hieroglyphic inscription on the top right-hand side, the Egyptian slave master, there's three of them standing in a row there, soldiers who are bossing them around, is describing these workers as lazy, using a term that will then occur, of course, we know in the book of Exodus, where this is the language of Pharaoh, where he will say of the Israelites, lazy. That's what you are, lazy. The same kind of language being used of these slaves. I can't say this is an image of the Israelites. It doesn't say that, but it fits with what we know of the story that we read in the book of Exodus. And that's a lot of what archaeology does. It doesn't say, here is an inscription that says the Israelites were here, but it does show that what we read in the Bible fits with what we know of the ancient world. What about the Exodus itself? There is no mention of Moses yet that's been found in the archaeological record. There's no mention of the plagues on Egypt. There's no mention of the crossing of the Red Sea or Sea of Reeds. These things are not recorded in the Egyptian records. So you might say, well, isn't that then a suggestion that the Bible is a myth or a legend? Well, no, because we have to remember what the purpose of writing is and what people recorded in the ancient world. And that's the reason for the image behind me right now. Actually, this one you can go see in the British Museum. The background there is the Morelands logo. That's where I teach, by the way. That's why this slide comes from a presentation I use at Morelands. This is a king list from ancient Egypt, and it's there in the British Museum today. But from Egypt, it's very interesting because it's a list of the kings of Egypt in chronological order over a long period of hundreds of years. But what's really interesting about it, from our point of view, is that there are a number of kings missing from the list. In other words, when the Egyptians recorded this list that goes down to the time of Ramesses, in this list, they deliberately ignore what they don't want to remember. They ignore certain kings. There's one particular set of kings they ignore in this king list. And in fact, they ignore it elsewhere, not just in this king list, but elsewhere in Egyptian history. There is an embarrassment to them in the Egyptian record. And it's one of the great mysteries for Egyptologists. Now, this isn't my area, so I'm only saying what the Egyptologists say, but the secular Egyptologists, so this isn't a particular, about whether people believe the Bible or not, but the secular Egyptologists know this is a very great mystery in Egyptian history. It's the story of a particular dynasty of Egyptian kings who had come, in biblical dating, just after the Exodus. And it's a series of Egyptian kings associated with what's called by the Egyptian historians the Amarna heresy. It was a heresy, according to the Egyptians, that was introduced by a certain pharaoh called Akhenaten. And not surprisingly, he's not mentioned in this king list. The pharaohs before are mentioned, pharaohs later are mentioned, but Akhenaten's not mentioned. Tutankhamun, the famous boy king, is the last of this dynasty. And it's a heretical movement in ancient Egypt's history. Why? Because Pharaoh Akhenaten introduced a heresy of monotheism. It's a mystery to the Egyptologists where this came from. The establishment for a brief period of time in Egypt's history of monotheism, the worship of one god. Overnight, Pharaoh Akhenaten abolished the worship of many gods. You know those pictures in the school books of Sobek, the crocodile-headed god, or Horus, and all these different kind of gods. Overnight, they were abolished, and the worship of one god, monotheism, was imposed on Egypt. The Temple of Karnak, if you visited Egypt, done the Nile cruise thing, you remember the Temple of Karnak. Akhenaten had it mothballed. The priests were all out of work. They were sacked. And he established a completely new headquarters at a place called Amarna, which is why we call it the Amarna heresy. The Egyptians, then in later history, reverted back to the worship of many gods, polytheism. And all this was undone. This attempt, this brief attempt at monotheism was undone. And Akhenaten's reputation was mud. And they obliterate him from their record. We've got lots and lots of examples of where you can see, you can just about work out where his name is, but it's been hacked away. As Egyptians tried to say, no, we're not going to remember him anymore. It would be like, I've got to be careful not to mention this. We're too near an election for me to mention. I can't mention any politician. Can I? But anyway, it would be like if there were a politician who we were so ashamed of afterwards that we want to try and obliterate their memory. Why? Because history tends to be written by the winners. And Egyptian historians only wanted to remember what they were proud of, their victories, their achievements. They did not want to remember what they were embarrassed about. There was, I haven't got time for that. Sorry, I was going to give you another example, but time's moving on. What we do have is the first direct mention of the Israelites. This is an Egyptian standing stone. It dates to around about 1210 BC, 1210 BC, so it's 3,200 years old. It's the first direct mention of the Israelites outside of the Bible. And it's from the Egyptians, they're the ones who mention the Israelites, and it talks about Israel as a people in the land of Canaan. This is called the Meneptah Stela. It's named after a pharaoh called Meneptah, and it's just a really interesting discovery from about 100 years ago, which shows how Pharaoh Meneptah went on an expedition around Canaan. And he records places like Jerusalem is mentioned on here, a town called Hatzor, a number of other cities in Canaan. And it also mentions Israel as a people, the Israelites, in the land of Canaan. Enemies of Egypt, but Pharaoh Meneptah mentions them. And it's because of him that we have this first direct mention of the Israelites outside of the Bible. They're not a people of legend or myth. They are historical people that even their enemies mention directly. Sorry, it's not a very clear image. That's what the Rosetta Stone would have originally looked like, by the way. If you see the Rosetta Stone all broken off at the top, it's kind of an iconic image, if you remember what the Rosetta Stone looks like. Well, originally it would have been a nice arch stela like this, and the text is in hieroglyphics. The nearer we come to the New Testament and to our own times, the more that's discovered that helps to confirm the Bible as a historical record. This is something very interesting that was found from about the 1960s onwards, in particular at three different sites dating to the time of King Solomon. What was discovered at three locations is that they had a very impressive new type of gateway. Some very significant architect had come up with an ingenious idea for a brilliant defensive fortification. They all date to the same time, and they're found in three particular cities. And you got the picture there of what they look like when they're recreated. Obviously, when archaeologists discover it, they only discover the foundations. That is an illustration to recreate it. But the foundations all show this same kind of design. What you're looking at here, 1, 2, 3 in the right-hand side there, are six chambers. And the six chambers form a kind of defensive gateway. Essentially, what you'd have to do to attack a building, look at the picture on the top left-hand side. If you're an attacking army, this new type of defense meant coming up the side, coming up the sort of pathway, through the first set of chambers, the gates there, through into this courtyard, where you then have to make a dogleg turn to the left, and then through this next set of chambers, which is this ground floor plan of the six chambers, in order to enter the city. The gate is the weakest point of any city, and so the gate has the strongest defences, but these are unique. So at one point in history, which would date to the time of King Solomon, we find a very elaborate type of gateway system. By the way, what's going on here? This is why it's so ingenious. Sorry, it's all about warfare, but it is ingenious. As attackers come up towards the gateway, the reason why they have to turn left, anybody guess why they have to turn left? To expose your sword arm. Yeah, that's right. So you expose your sword arm, which of course doesn't have the shield. I'm afraid most people were right-handed. For those who are left-handed, it's always been that way. That's why Ehud, if you know in the book of Judges, could get away with what he did. Read the story if you don't know it. He could get away with what he did because most people were right-handed. And therefore, doing this left-hand turn exposed their sword arm to a rain of arrows and spears and debris and so on. That's called the killing zone, that little courtyard. So courtyard sounds quite romantic, doesn't it? But it wasn't. And then through on the left, you then have a system of gates you have to knock through. And after each gate, there are two chambers, one either side, where there would have been soldiers waiting for you. So each time you get through a gate, you have another set of soldiers waiting for you. And that would be the type of defensive chamber that's shown in these three places. Now, what's interesting about this is these three locations that have these gated chambers, it's Hatzor, Megiddo, and Ai, those are the three that are mentioned in 1 Kings as the cities that King Solomon built up and fortified. The very three that are mentioned as being fortified by Solomon are the very three that archaeologists have discovered have this unique and distinctive type of architecture. The thing about architecture is it implies a common mind behind it. Somebody thought this up. Somebody came up with this idea of a defensive fortification. And somebody had the money and the wealth to make it happen. And so this would seem to have the fingerprints of King Solomon all over it, these particular gated chambers. That's why they're called the six-chambered, they're called Solomonic gateways, Solomon's gates. Okay, I'm going to make sure we do have time to stop in a moment, but I just want to give you an example of language from the ancient world. Lots of people will be told that the Bible itself, the Old Testament, has been written much later than the events about which it speaks. In fact, there's a very popular theory which has been around for a good 100 years and is often taught, even at a GCSE RE course will have this content. It will teach that the Old Testament essentially formed long after the exile, as different traditions were put together to give us the Old Testament we have. And therefore, the Old Testament emerged long after the events about which it speaks. Now, in order to reply to that, we'd need to ask, well, where's our earliest Old Testament? Where are the earliest Old Testament writings that we have? Now, the reality is, manuscripts and parchments and so on, they do wear out pretty quickly. So it's remarkable. We have a vast amount for the New Testament from the 1st century, 2nd century onwards. But as we go back before the 1st century, of course there is very little because very little survives from the ancient world. The best written documents from the ancient world are actually documents that were inscribed on clay tablets. And those come from places like Iraq and Egypt, modern day. So those kind of tablets survive. But if you're going to write on vellum, which is animal skin, or on parchment or papyrus, really, if you go back before 2,000 years ago, very little survives at all. Now, I could spend some time talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls. I won't spend much time talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, only to say that the Dead Sea Scrolls are remarkable for giving us documents from the time of Jesus and just a little bit before, but they don't take us back any further than that. I mean, the Dead Sea Scrolls are very remarkable, and their discovery was very important, but they can't get us back much further than the time of Jesus. The one most important find in terms of the Old Testament from the Dead Sea Scrolls was the discovery of the complete scroll of Isaiah. That complete scroll of Isaiah was much earlier than the time of the Dead Sea community itself. It was like an old book, an antique book they had, if you like. So when the Dead Sea Scroll community sealed up their library, they had within it a complete scroll of Isaiah, which was much earlier still. That's probably the earliest Old Testament book that we have, actually, the book of Isaiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and probably dates to around about 200 BC. Between 1 and 200 BC. But can we get back earlier with the Old Testament? Well, often what's taught in schools and at universities is that we can't. The Old Testament is a late book, and the stories in it can't be trusted because it was written so much later. Now, that's a theory, and there's not a single scrap of evidence to confirm that theory, but there are scraps of evidence that have been appearing that disconfirm the theory. In other words, what has been found, gradually, the little things that have been found, indicate the antiquity of the Old Testament, that this is a very ancient book indeed. Okay, in order to show you this one and to just explain the video clip you're going to see, I've just got to explain one little technical point, and that's this. Just bear with me. If you don't want to follow this technical point, you can nod off at this point and I'll wake you up in a moment, right? But I just got to explain this so the clip makes sense. When critical scholars talk about the Old Testament, one way they describe the forming of the Old Testament is to say there are four sources, J, E, D, and P. Now, those aren't particularly attractive names, J, E, D, P. You know, if you're going to call a book anything, you wouldn't really call it J. But those are the four names that they've been given, J, E, D, and P. And those are four different sources that were put together to give the Old Testament we have. As we have it today. That's the kind of critical theory that goes around. And these four sources are very, very late and belong to a time long after the exile that they were put together as one book. Deuteronomy is seen as one of these sources, one of JEDP. And therefore, this theory would put these sources coming together as the Old Testament you have as very late. However, this discovery that you're going to see now on the screen, the Ketef Hinnom tablet, is the earliest quotation from Deuteronomy, but not only from Deuteronomy, on a single scroll that's been found. It was found relatively recently, and you'll just see the site director at this particular cleanup operation explaining how it was found. And it's a scroll that has two different texts from the Old Testament. And as you hear it explained, what I just want you to notice as well is just how happen chance the discovery was. It's just how remarkable how much can be missed because it came about quite by accident that this was discovered. So this is the silver scroll called the Ketef Hinnom tablet. What you're looking at, by the way, on the screen, just for the video clip that comes on, is this is, again, aerial view. So you're up in a helicopter, I guess now, looking down on a tomb. So it's an Israelite tomb from Jerusalem, just outside of Jerusalem. The roof of the tomb has been knocked off. That's why it's exposed. But you can see little holes, little openings, and it's into one of those openings we're going to go now on this video clip. Oh, by the way, there's a picture of the scroll itself unfolded. It's a silver scroll, and inscribed on the scroll here is the Hebrew, and it's going to explain that from Numbers and Deuteronomy, two different passages are quoted on this one scroll. Here we go.
These look like a bunch of holes in the ground. What are we looking at here?
This is a burial cave, 2,600 years old. We had a bunch of kids who were in the dangerous ages of 12 and 13. They were from an archaeology club for youth. And one of those kids was especially a nagging type. I didn't know what to do with this little Nathan, who always had a very ugly habit of pulling my shirt from behind, and whenever I would turn around, he would ask me silly questions.
He was known as Nathan the Unbearable?
I don't know his surname. When I saw the entrance there to the repository, I looked into it. I saw that there was a rock surface visible. Well, I thought this is also looted, as are the other caves which we previously excavated in the vicinity. I said to myself, this is the place to put little Nathan.
You stuck him into the tomb?
Yes, I thought that I'm not going to see him for a while. So I put him into this place and told him that he has to prepare it for photography. After about 15 minutes, I feel my shirt being pulled from behind.
Nathan.
When I turn around, I see this creature, Nathan, with almost complete pottery vessels in his hands. This time I grabbed his shirt, and that was against all instructions. He was not supposed to move anything. He made the discovery of my life, not his, mine.
That's right. Okay, let's go in there.
I was there already.
Want to come in here?
No.
Is it clean in here?
No.
It's dirty?
It is.
What was the discovery? In this tomb where Nathan found the pots, Gabby's crew found amongst the bones of the ancient people buried here something that appeared to be a cigarette butt. This apparent trash turned out to be two tightly rolled silver scrolls, the greatest discovery of Professor Barkai's life so far.
What's this green mold on the wall?
Green mold.
But it took them several years to realize the real value of the treasure. Ugh.
When it was opened, we found it is
took a... Took 3 years.
About after 3 years. It was difficult to unroll it. When the proper method was found, we saw that it is a plaque of approximately 10 centimeters in size, and upon it was covered densely with writing.
On two silver scrolls, you can read a biblical passage. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord cause his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and grant you peace. These scrolls are exactly the same as the Bible today, and they're 600 years older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Torah hasn't changed. The tradition is good, but the greatest discovery was yet to come. For 20 years, the scrolls sat in the Israel Museum. Then in the 90s, Professor Barkai initiated tests involving new NASA imaging techniques, which revealed more biblical writings. This time, not from the Book of Numbers, but the Book of Deuteronomy.
We discovered that there is another biblical or Torah verse on it.
So 25 years after you find this thing, you actually find a whole new thing right before your eyes.
Yes. Wow. It was written there, keeps the great covenant. God who keeps his covenant and his grace to his lovers and the keepers of his commandments.
Beautiful.
This is a verse which comes from the seventh chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. And this is source D. P and D together for the first time.
So that's the reference to the two different sources there, the D and P together. The Ketuv Hinnom tablet would then be, or the scroll, I should say, would be the earliest quoting of the same biblical material that we read in the Old Testament, and yet now pushing back the dates beyond what a lot of radical, critical scholars had wanted to suggest for the Old Testament. Nothing has emerged that confirms that radical, skeptical view. Anything that has emerged has confirmed the reliability, the authenticity, the antiquity of the biblical record that we have. Just to give you another example of how this works, you know, the thing that archaeologists are really looking for, that the real thing archaeologists want to find isn't gold, despite Indiana Jones. I mean, gold and jewelry is lovely, but the thing that their eyes are fixed on trying to find are written records, writings. There's always a quest to try and find a lost library. You know, any of these tells, these locations. Generally, if it's a big city, there should be a library somewhere. And the library would be the real treasure store that people want to find. Because written documents, they give you access into people's minds, what they were thinking, what they recorded. And for a long time, people had said, well, there's no reference to David outside of the Bible. If King David was such an important figure, we would have references to him elsewhere outside of the Bible. But from his time, we don't have direct references to David outside of the Bible. And therefore, maybe King David is like a sort of a Robin Hood figure, a King Arthur, a kind of mythological figure. Maybe he wasn't a real figure at all. And that idea still goes around. We still hear that circulating. And this was only found, what I'm going to show you now, in rubble in the early 90s, a relatively recent find. This is Dan that you're looking at here, city of Dan. You know, we talk about Dan to Beersheba in the Old Testament, in the Bible, Dan to Beersheba. Dan would be the northernmost town in Galilee, Beersheba the southernmost. So Dan to Beersheba was a way of saying, like, you know, John O'Groats to Penzance. Dan to Beersheba. Well, Dan, the northernmost town, just in sight of Mount Hermon, disappearing into the cloud there, has already been excavated. A great deal of work has been done there. But in the rubble of a wall in 1992 was discovered this really important inscription. It's part of it. It's called the Tel Dan inscription. And it's not Tel Dan something. It comes from Tel. You've got that word right. Tel Dan. The inscription itself is the first direct reference to David outside of the Bible, to the house of David. It also mentions the house of Israel and the king of Israel, because at this time, Judah and Israel had split from each other. But from within 100 years of the life of King David was a direct reference to the house of David, to the dynasty of David. So this inscription that you're looking at is nearly 3,000 years old, and it's a 3,000-year-old inscription directly referring to the dynasty of King David. Again, until it was found, people could make the claim, well, there's no direct reference to David from the time outside of the Bible. But you know, an absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Did you follow that this time on a Sunday night? An absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. The fact something hasn't been found doesn't mean it's not there to be found, or that it never existed. And this proves that in many cases, we just have to wait. Archaeology, a young discipline, the more it's done, the more it's discovered, that confirms the biblical record as historical. Now, I've got a few more things I want to share with you, including one particularly exciting thing from Jordan. But before I do that, let's pause there and have a chance for open questions. Zara, David's got the microphone there, so if there's anything you want to ask or come back on now, let's spend a few minutes doing that before I cover a little bit more ground with you. Oh, and I will get to Jesus, by the way, in case you're wondering. So David's got the microphone there. If there is anything you want to pick up on now before I crack on. So would anyone like to come in with anything now?
Okay, it might be a little technical. But you're talking about Tel Dan tablet there. You said it was found in rubble in a wall.
Yeah.
How did you date it then?
Yep. Well, now, it's dated because actually it isn't an inscription from the Israelites. It's an inscription written by the Arameans, who are another people living next door. And it comes from a particular Aramean king of a particular time who's boasting about having destroyed cities of Israel and Judah. So the historical dating comes from the content, who's written it and what he's commemorating, because often these inscriptions would originally have been some kind of boast of something they'd done. So it comes from a non-Israelite Aramean people. So it's dated by, number one, content. Number two, by language. It's not actually, though it looks like Hebrew, it's not actually Hebrew. It's Aramean. So it's a script and a language that also helps date it. And it was written by the enemies. Now, it was smashed up and put into a wall. Now, how that really helps with dating, what obviously happened, the story must be the Israelites, presumably, wherever this standing stone was, they just had a battle or a fight or whatever, smashed the stone up and used it as rubble in their own building work. Now, because they were using it as fill, basically, that really helps with dating because then it's sealed in architecture. And so if you find something like, for example, if somebody was to knock down your house, you know, road builders, okay? They're going to build a road through your house, and they knock it down, and they find something in the foundations, lodged in the foundations. That's really helpful for dating, because chances are you didn't dig into the foundations to put it there. Chances are that means it was put there when the house was built on top. So the fact it was used as rubble for fill inside a wall, that's enormously helpful for dating. So they know the wall, because of pottery and associated remains, dates to a certain period. So the fill inside must be earlier or as part of the construction. So that's all the kind of reasons for dating it to, give or take, only a few years, give or take, to within 100 years of David. Well, it's a number of things.
You've got an earliest date. It can't be any later than this date.
Yes, it can't be any later, that's right.
But you don't have anything other than contextual for the earliest date.
Apart from the content. The content helps with that, because it's a particular king who's making, an Aramean king who's making his boasts, and so that helps to fit it in. So it couldn't be much, it couldn't go back too much earlier. Yeah, yeah. Great. Technical question, yeah. Yeah. Good thing. They don't have to be as technical. But they can be. There's one over here. Make David walk. It's good.
Hello. You live in the wonderful county of Dorset, is that right?
I do.
So yeah. Are you far from the Jurassic Coast?
I'm not far from the Jurassic Coast.
And do you have a good old rummage around there?
I do. I take my boys down there. We take a little hammer. Don't tell the authorities. We've got a lovely half an hour. We were out there. You asked your question. I was going to give you a funny anecdote. But
no, that was my question. Do you get much interest out of the Jurassic Coast? And it's,
yeah. I love all that, yeah. But, I mean, it doesn't tie in particularly with biblical...
No.
I haven't found much to do with King David. No. But I've got a nice ammonite. Yeah, sorry, but did you... I mean, was it a particular question on that? Or just out of interest? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't say much. I mean, it does raise a question, of course, about geology and Genesis and Noah and, you know, there's all those kind of questions, which I don't tend to go into. I could say something about that now, but it's a... You know, that's a whole evening in itself.
You said that the plagues weren't... You didn't find any evidence of the plagues in Egypt. I'm wondering why the Egyptians wouldn't have written about, say, the killing of the firstborn sons.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think about what the purpose of writing is. And writing is to record your victory and success, especially for the Egyptians. It seems that the Egyptians really admired their writing as a way of, almost a magical way of cementing their importance. And so you don't record failure or defeat. A fantastic example of this one is the famous ancient Battle of Kadesh. Now, bear with me on this one. Under Ramses II, the Egyptians had a really important battle in the ancient world, the Battle of Kadesh. It happened in the region of Syria, modern-day Syria, just north of Israel. And we know this from the ancient world, really important battle. The Egyptians recorded it, and so it was a fantastic battle between the Egyptians under Ramses and the Hittites. And the Egyptians had a resounding success over the Hittites. And so we know about this story, and the Egyptians recorded it. Until the 1920s. In the 1920s in Turkey, archaeologists discovered the lost civilization of the Hittites. It had been lost to history. Nobody knew anything about the Hittites outside of the other records of the Egyptians and so on. But in the 1920s, they discovered in Anatolia, what we call Turkey, the Hittite civilization. And lo and behold, they found a Hittite library. Lots of those Hittite documents are in the British Museum now. They've got a sort of a room dedicated to the Hittites. And lo and behold, in the library, they found a record of the Battle of Kadesh. So what the classical scholars had known for thousands of years, we'd known about the Battle of Kadesh and people had written about it as a resounding Egyptian victory. Guess what the Hittites said? The Hittites said it was a resounding victory for the Hittites. Nowadays, scholars reckon it was a stalemate between the two because both recorded it as a resounding victory. Because in the ancient world, that's how history was written. So you wouldn't expect a record of disaster or defeat. And that's one of the things that stands out about the Bible, by the way, the Old Testament. In contrast, the Old Testament is not propaganda. The Old Testament records weaknesses and failures. I mean, it really is remarkable for this, you know, the Old Testament. You think about King David. King David, the glorious king of ancient Israel's history. What a villain. It records warts and all what David was really like. It records David the adulterer, David the schemer, the murderer. David, who in his song, Psalm 51, would say, I've been sinful from my mother's womb. You know, that's reality, not propaganda. And that's why the Bible begins to start a new way of writing history, a way of writing history that's not propaganda, let me just tell you about my successes, but a way of recording truth, a way of recording how things really, really happened. So that would be my suggestion as to why we don't have a record. But I mean, having said that, who knows what may yet emerge or be discovered? I mean, there's a few more things I could say about the plagues, but it is true that as far as I'm aware, there's no direct reference. I mean, there's an ambiguous text that was found by the Sphinx, actually, between the paws of the Sphinx, that does possibly have a bearing on the death of the firstborn. And I mean, there's some very speculative stuff I could tell you about, but I won't go into that now. Yes. Yeah, one more and then, yeah.
You just talked about most of the writing in that time was propaganda, but the Bible was realistic. When would the writing have changed to more realism more widely?
Well, I mean, you still got the propaganda thing, even with Herodotus, the father of history, really, with the Greeks in sort of 600 BC. So you still got a kind of propaganda style of history writing. But by sort of classical times, you begin to find, you know, more of a sense of trying to record not just what you want your hearers to hear, but trying to record something about what really happened. And so you begin to find that emerging. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't actually think there is any such thing as neutral history. You know, all history, in some sense, is from a perspective. All history has got a message to share. So I'm not, you know, I mean, even the Bible itself, I mean, it's history with a purpose. It's not like, here's just the bare facts. It's history with a message. And so in that sense, there's no neutral history. But I think the Bible does pioneer a developing way of thinking about recording the way things really are, not just what we want you to think of us as a people. The Bible really isn't just history, it's his story. It's about God, ultimately. It's about theological history, if you like. It's pointing us to God. So I don't want to suggest there's any kind of neutral history, even today. I mean, even, you know, now when you turn on a BBC history program, read it with a filter, you know, listen to it with a filter, because I don't think there is such a thing as neutral history. But I think that aiming towards trying to be more objective is something which I think comes from a biblical worldview. I mean, I think that is a fruit of the biblical worldview, that we should want to aim for objectivity, to be fair to our enemies, to be fair to our opponents in the way we record things. So I think it's an emerging discipline, history, but I wouldn't put a date on it. I mean, I think it develops over time, but yeah. But I mean, like, Josephus is the great Jewish historian of the first century. We know a lot from Josephus that's really helpful for understanding the background of the time of Jesus. That's first century. But Josephus clearly embellishes things. We know that very clearly, that as a historian, he particularly wanted to sell himself as well, and to make claims about himself. And he had a particular agenda to promote the Jewish people to the Roman authorities. So Josephus, he has an agenda as well, but we rely on Josephus for a lot of history of the time of Jesus, first century. Yeah. Let me share with you something else. This is just from the last 2 years, this one. And again, if I explain it to you, it'll just show you a little bit about like how archaeology works and how useful it is to use archaeology to cast light on the Bible, and the two kind of help us to reread the Bible and perhaps think about what happened in the Bible in the light of what we know from history. Let's take this example then, and I'll explain the picture before I tell you the example. This is from Jordan, so we're going over the River Jordan now, in modern-day Jordan. Ancient Israel spread over the banks, so it wasn't all in what we call Israel today. The modern nation of Israel, the borders aren't quite the same as ancient Israel. So we're in Jordan over the other side of the river, and this is at Tel El Hammam, and this is a site that's been excavated for about 15 years, maybe 20 years, and just in the last couple of years, the site director, Stephen Collins, has claimed that this is the site of Sodom, biblical Sodom. Now, I'll explain a bit about why he makes that claim, and then what light that may cast on the Bible. But here's a big one, right? Biblical city of Sodom. The record of what we read happening in Sodom, in the Bible, is a graphic and stunning event, and you would expect there to be some kind of a record to show for it. You know, what happened at Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember the story in Genesis where Abraham's nephew Lot is in Sodom, and the angels have come to destroy Sodom because of its wickedness, and Gomorrah as well. And what happens? Well, we read about a destruction with fire and brimstone. And we read, very famously, what happens to Lot's wife? Very famously, turned into a pillar of salt. And so it's a very famous kind of story. And it's one that you probably hear more about in Sunday school stories than anywhere else. And if there's a candidate for myth and legend, it's got to be Sodom and Gomorrah. That would seem to be a strong candidate for a myth. And yet Stephen Collins has suggested he's found Sodom. What is the evidence that he's found such a city? And what light would it cast on our reading of the Bible? Well, first thing to say is if you look in a Bible atlas, most of the Bible maps and so on, if you're going to look for where Sodom and Gomorrah are, what you'll probably find is the Dead Sea. River Jordan flows down at the Dead Sea. Lowest point on earth, so the water can't get out of the Dead Sea other than by evaporation. That's why it's so, one of the reasons why it's so salty. And there at the southern end of the Dead Sea, you probably will find in a Bible atlas or a map in the Bible, two little dots, Sodom, Gomorrah, maybe with question marks by them, because nobody really knows. But if they're anywhere, people think somewhere on the southern shore of the Dead Sea, and no one's found the remains. And so maybe it's all myth and legend anyway. Well, here's the other side to this story. This is the location that's been excavated. And Tel al-Hammam is north of the Dead Sea, not south. So that's interesting. He's excavating a location that is north of the Dead Sea. And that's not where Bible maps would ever have pointed to try and identify Sodom. Well, why does Stephen Collins think he's found the location? Well, the first reason is he's gone back to the Bible and read it, not thinking about where those Bible atlases put the little dots, but thinking, what description does Genesis give? Let's assume that it records a real event. Now, I mean, regardless of whether you believe in miracles, regardless of even whether you believe in God, let's just assume the Bible gives accurate observational record and then think about where it might be. And in the book of Genesis, it describes the location of Sodom and Gomorrah as on a Hebrew word, the kikar of the Jordan, the kikar. Now, that's a Hebrew word meaning a disc. Or a plane, it's translated in the NIV, it's translated plane, plane or a disc. Now that's interesting because there's only one place that would count as a disc-shaped plane. And that would be here on the north end. So if you look at the picture shows it clear rather than a satellite image. You've got the Dead Sea, Jericho on the left-hand side, Tel al-Hammam on the right-hand side. And you could pretty well trace out a kikar, a disc-like shape, a plane in a circular shape that would be that region between the hills of the central hill country where Jerusalem is, up above Jericho, and then the hill country of Moab and Jordan on the other side of the river. So you've got this plain in between, and that would be the kikar. That would fit with the record. And then Stephen Collins also noticed that the observations in Genesis are that Abraham was at a place called Bethel when he sees Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed. Now that's interesting because Bethel is in the central hill country above Jericho, so it's just up above Jericho there. And the only place that he would have been able to see from that region, from Bethel, would be something in this kikar, this plain, this disc-like shape above the Dead Sea. He couldn't have seen anything on the southern end of the Dead Sea. He could not have seen the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, if they were down there. He couldn't have seen the smoke rising or anything else. It would be too far away. The only location that would fit would be something on this north end of the Dead Sea. Well, what have the excavations found? Well, what's been discovered is that at the time of Abraham, so you've got to go back nearly 4,000 years ago, the landscape was very different. Now, again, if you've been out to Israel on a tour, you'll know that if you've been down to Jericho, apart from Jericho, which is an oasis, it's a pretty desolate region. It's desert-like. It's pretty dry and barren. It's not a very wealthy place to live. But what's been discovered is a really important Bronze Age city, a city where there would have been great wealth, significant fortifications. I mean, this is obviously a recreation. This is the Tell, remains of the Tell. And then they do a like computer simulation of, given the foundations they found, how big the walls and the towers would have been. This would have been a really wealthy city, Bronze Age city. And that's because the region would have been much more fertile than it is today. So again, if you go to Israel, don't see it the way we see it today, that northern Dead Sea region is just desert. It would have been fertile. It would have been a place with lots of crops and agriculture and big, important Bronze Age cities. Far more important than Jerusalem would have been this city. So what was this city and why did it cease to exist? Because what has been discovered at this site is that whatever this city was, it ceased to exist almost overnight. It finished. And it wasn't reoccupied. Jericho was reoccupied. This city wasn't. What brought it to an end? Well, one of the finds is really intriguing. And it's this is a picture of it. It's these are pottery shards. But on these pottery shards, pottery survives really well from the ancient world. It's one of the best things to find on archaeological sites. But these pottery shards have a very distinctive feature to them. And that is, one side just looks like a bit of pottery. The other side is glazed with something called trinitite. Now, trinitite is a kind of semi-precious stone in the ancient world. And it forms in very rare circumstances. Trinitite is kind of like a greenish glass. That's what it would look like. They found trinitite jewelry in Tutankhamun's tomb when Howard Carter entered it back in the early 1900s. Trinitite is a very rare glassy kind of substance. Now, how does it form and what is it? Well, the clue is in the name, trinitite. It's a modern name that's been given to this substance. And the reason why, you may get it from the word trinity, if you are old enough to remember this. The place where trinitite also occurs is here in America, where the Trinity atom bomb testing was carried out. You see, what trinitite is, it forms under very, very special circumstances, including in Mexico, where when the atom bomb was tested back in the 1940s in the desert area, after the explosion of an atom bomb, sand would form trinitite. What you need is incredibly high temperature in a blast that then stops. And in that kind of condition, sand turns to green glass, or trinitite, to give it its technical term. So trinitite will form there. Now, why was trinitite in Tutankhamun's tomb? Tutankhamun did not have nuclear weapons. It's not because the Egyptians were involved in atom bomb testing. The reason why trinitite is in Tutankhamun's tomb is that there is another way it can form, and that is through some kind of meteorite, some sort of blast, which would cause that kind of intense heat very suddenly and then pretty sudden cooling afterwards. I don't know if you remember, did you see on TV a couple of years ago, people had like cameras that filmed in Russia a meteorite burning up in the atmosphere, a big one that came through the atmosphere and burned up. So if a big one comes through the atmosphere, you get like a fireball and it can burn up in the atmosphere. And that kind of heat that's generated, the blast on the Earth, if it was big enough, would cause trinitite to form, would cause sand to turn to glass. This would be the most likely explanation for trinitite forming at this location in Jordan. In other words, some kind of blast that was so hot that it caused pottery to glaze on one side into trinitite. So the other side still remains pottery. It's still identifiable. It's not sand. It's pottery. But one side has become this greenish glaze, this trinitite. And that would be formed in these kind of conditions. So Stephen Collins has just now published this claim that this would fit with biblical Sodom. Why? Well, it's an important Bronze Age city from the time of Abraham. It suddenly ceases to exist. There's a neighboring town, by the way, which would then be Gomorrah. It would fit with the circumstances, and even the circumstances of its destruction would fit with the description we read in Genesis of what Abraham saw. Now, there is no signpost saying, "Welcome to Sodom." There is no inscription that's been found that says, "This is Sodom." That's not been found. But what we do seem to have here is a set of circumstances that fit very well with what we read in the Bible. And that, for the most part, is what archaeology does. Evidence is provided that fits with what we read in the Bible. Now, of course, it would be open to people to question that and to debate that. And this is only a very recent one. It's only from the last couple of years, so the debate will go on. If you want to read about it, there is a book published on this. But in terms of what archaeology does, this is how it works. And again, it confirms the point I made earlier, that as archaeology unfolds, more and more is found that confirms the biblical record as reliable, and nothing has been found that undermines the reliability of the Bible. I said I'd get to Jesus at the end. Well, actually, I haven't really got time, which is a terrible thing to say at the end of an evening. Obviously, I could elaborate in terms of evidence reliability of Jesus. Remember, we'll just say there are a couple of books that I hate to do this, right? I recommend my own books at the end. But just say in finishing, I have got a couple of books at the back if you want to read further. One of them is called Confident Christianity, which is a more general book on the evidence for Christianity. And that will go into more detail in terms of the evidence from science as well, a different area that we haven't tackled tonight, and also evidence for the reliability of the New Testament and the historicity of Jesus. The other book just ties in with what I've been covering with you this evening is called Time Travel to the Old Testament. And that one is written as a kind of like, imagine you were a time traveler in this world of the Old Testament. What would it look like? What would you see? What people would you meet? How would you travel? Those kind of questions, which I think is helpful because it helps us to open up the Old Testament, not just as a reliable book, which I do think matters, but also as a book where you'll feel more at home. A book where you can think, well, these were people like us. They had hopes and aspirations and disappointments and struggles. And I think we should find more of a home in the Old Testament. And that's why I wrote this book. So Time Travel to the Old Testament tries to do that. How much are they, you're asking? Retail price. That's what I should do. This is the salesman's way of doing it, isn't it? They're £10 each. And I think Amazon is listing it at that price. But for you tonight, £10. Among friends, £7. No, that'd be too much. £5 each. Two for a tenner. So if you want to get a copy, there are copies at the back, and you're welcome to those. So David, I will bring this into our landing now and finish there. I mean, I'm very happy with questions, but I realise I've reached the end of time, so maybe if...
Well, I'm slightly aware that the youth group needs to go off to their meeting, so we'll stop now. But do see, Chris can be around for about the next 25
That's fine.
Minutes
yeah,
before
yeah.
he goes over and joins the youth. Brave man. And so do come and ask him a question, especially if you're a visitor here today. Do come and ask him about anything. I found this fascinating. A lot of what you said echoes. I did a history degree in Durham and then a theology degree in Cambridge. And I remember being very frustrated at Cambridge because that sort of radical scepticism, which would not have been accepted within history, was somehow given scope within the looking at the Bible. Certainly in history, if I had come across a document like the Bible, it would have been a huge resource, which I'd want to use a lot. And yet, suddenly, there was airtime given to some quite incredible speculation.
That's right.
Skeptical speculation.
But. Yeah, it's given so much prominence. I did a debate with a man you may have heard of called Richard Dawkins. Yeah. And he said, well, he's spoken to his scholar friends at Oxford, and they say they looked at Israel and there's no evidence there. Just a sort of dismissive claim. And it's such a blinkered view. I mean, I know there are two particular very sceptical academics at Oxford who kind of like, they push this line that there's really nothing there. And it is so far away from the truth, and yet that gets peddled so much.
Yes, and actually I would commend the British Museum. It's a good place to go to find artifacts which speak of... the Bible. I can't remember. It's a Persian king who's mentioned. I think it's Persian king mentioned in the Bible. Who for ages people said, well, the Bible must be wrong because he was the leader of this vast empire at the time, and yet we have no record of him outside of the Bible, which is inconceivable. Until recently, they discovered, I think it was a seal, which has his name on it. And you suddenly think, I mean, that shows what this sort of ancient world, or really ancient world, was like. That we have huge gaps in our knowledge. And what you said about a lack of evidence not being evidence for nothing is absolutely right. Well, we're going to stop there. Do come and talk to Chris afterwards. And thank you very much for coming tonight. Do come back another time to St. Patrick's if you're visiting. And if you're not visiting, do come back another time to St. Patrick's. thank you very much for coming. And thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Cool.